It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Dar Jamail. He is an independent journalist who has just recently come back from spending 8 months in Iraq, and he's going to be giving us an update on what is happening there. Dar, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let me begin and ask you, what was it that motivated you to go to Iraq in the first place?
Well, after watching the sell job performed by the media during the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, basically perpetuating all what we see now very clearly to be lies, and then the coverage of the war as if it was some sort of high-tech video game, not showing the realities on the ground whatsoever, and then how the occupation was covered, I really just was outraged because I was using the internet to read foreign media and alternative media coverage of the same events and basically witnessing a different reality. And so I decided to go there for on my own and basically try to cover it myself because I really couldn't see another more positive thing I could do to try to bring the truth out about the situation. So I figured out how to get in there, and I managed to get in there and started working. And then once I got there, I saw that the disparity was even greater than I saw before I even got there. I was just amazed. It was as if literally myself covering a completely different situation than that which was being covered by corporate media, and saw very quickly that most of them didn't even leave their hotels, and that unless they were going to embed or go into the green zone to a press conference. And it's just amazing the impacts of that, and this continues to this day, especially regarding the recent election, where we have literally the situation on the ground being 180 degrees different than what's being portrayed by most of the corporate media.
So give us some specifics. What differences did you see between, let's say, daily life in Iraq versus what U.S. corporate media was projecting?
Well, even now, for example, we had all of this recent hoopla over this election, which was horribly misrepresented, I should add, and we should talk about that in a little bit. But as far as daily life, right now, there really isn't any more coverage on the fact that there's 70% unemployment in Baghdad, which is probably the best electricity in Iraq outside of Kurdistan. There's around 6 hours of electricity per day. In most of the rest of the country, there's 3 hours of electricity per day. At times, there's no running water when people turn on their taps. And then when there is water, if you drink it, you're probably going to get very, very sick and get kidney stones and diarrhea, nausea, and other waterborne diseases. And the fact the security is so horrendous that most women and children are too afraid to even leave their homes anymore. Kidnappings are through the roof. The crime rate is at least four times as bad as in the worst city in America. This is the situation. There's car bombs on a daily basis. There's 75 attacks on U.S. forces on it every single day, at least on average. This is the situation. And instead, we are shown images of happy Iraqis holding up inked fingers in the street, taken by corporate media who were allowed to go to four different polling stations in Baghdad, and that's it. And they were in predominantly Shia neighborhoods, and they were locations where there was expected to be very high turnout. And it was these images were used to sell an election in order to justify a failed occupation and an invasion based on lies. And the facts are that people were voting because they believed that it was going to end the occupation, and that they were voting for electricity and for jobs and for security and for their a true government, a true sovereign government, which they didn't have before and which they still won't have after these elections. And none of this was reported whatsoever. And when we look at those images of Iraqis, proud Iraqis voting, and it was a very momentous thing for them to do that, and they believed it. But when we look at those images with this in mind, that they're actually voting because most of them cannot even tolerate the occupation another day, and they want it to end as quickly as possible. And when we look at these images through that lens, we see a completely different reality. And to me, that symbolizes basically the sell job that has been done and continues to be done by the corporate media about Iraq. It's really Orwellian and deeply troubling.
One of the images that the corporate media puts across our television sets each night is that the Iraqi resistance is made up of outsiders and former Ba'athists. What did you find to be the truth there?
Well, I've interviewed many resistance fighters myself, and there are some who are ex-military. Of course, Paul Bremer, by immediately disbanding the military, in effect created the resistance immediately. We have hundreds of thousands of unemployed, armed, trained men, and what are they going to do? So many of them are ex-military. Some of them are Saddam loyalists. But as far as foreign fighters, it's definitely less than 5% are actual foreign fighters, people coming from outside. And the resistance, their goal, the people that I've spoken with in the resistance, all of them state that their goal is to simply get the occupiers out of their country. They don't really have much of an ideology behind that other than they are fighting the foreign occupier of their country, which, of course, it's their right to do. But then you have to differentiate within the resistance because these people doing... I have yet to speak with anyone over there that says they are involved in kidnappings and they are involved in car bombings or beheadings, that they say this is not even Iraqis that do this. There are now actually foreign fighters coming into Iraq, which did not exist under the former regime. One thing that you have when you have an extremely brutal dictator is you do tend to have good security. As long as you don't cross him, anyone else that's breaking the law is not going to get away with it for very long. So there weren't terrorist organizations in Iraq before. But now, with the borders essentially having been left wide open throughout most of the occupation, we have foreign groups coming in and doing car bombs. And I think when we see these incidents, such as yesterday, where car bombs detonated at mosques and suicide bombers going into mosques and killing scores of Iraqis, that those are probably outsiders, because most Iraqis, when they see these things, while even Iraqis who don't tolerate the armed resistance because they're so tired of the violence, they are quick to differentiate. They say, you know, these people doing these suicide bombings, killing so many people, so many Iraqis, they're not Iraqis and they're not Muslims, because no true Iraqi and no true Muslim would do these things.
You mentioned earlier 75 attacks a day, and that's another difference with your journalism and independent foreign press, is that if you're looking at the nightly news, you tend to get the impression that there was maybe one or two major attacks a day. 75 seems like quite a bit.
That's right. They don't report the fact that most U.S. bases are being mortared on a daily basis, and the situation of the troops, that they're sitting in their bases where oftentimes they don't even have access to email for weeks at a time. Oftentimes they don't have enough food and water. And then when they're on patrol, which are being mortared on almost a nightly basis, and then when they're on patrol, they're essentially moving targets. There are an average that the military admits to, which means we can assume that it's probably much more than this, but an average of 75 attacks per day. Just to give you an example, in December, after the siege of Fallujah had been going on for about a month, which that siege actually was begun with the goal of creating security and stability for the January 30 elections. And in December, in one day alone, only in Baghdad, there were 66 attacks on the U.S. military there. And the media is not showing even a true glimpse at how horrendous the situation is for the military there and how heavily they're being attacked on a daily basis and the weapons being used by the resistance against them. I mean, now we have roadside bombs that are taking out entire tanks. This, and they portray these people as ill-trained, radical, ignorant, bloodthirsty, savage, and quote-unquote insurgents. And no, actually, it's becoming a very highly organized, technically capable resistance that by the day is getting better at killing U.S. soldiers who are there illegally in this situation, using a conventional army to fight a guerrilla war that it's completely failed. And essentially what we have in Iraq now is a very large, very well-armed Beirut, if you will, like the Lebanese war, where at one point we had 23 different factions fighting each other. And that's what Iraq is quickly degrading into, especially now after the elections.
talk a little bit more about Fallujah, if you would. I interviewed Karen Parker, an attorney down in California, who is pursuing through the OAS a human rights claim against the United States for atrocities there in Fallujah. Did you come upon any evidence that would support that?
Oh, yes. There's mounds of evidence to support that. Even back in April, which was a very mild siege compared to the current one, which is ongoing, when I was in there, I was at a clinic. And for starters, I had three personal friends who rode out on an ambulance. Two of them are Westerners, to collect Iraqis, because anytime Iraqis went, they were immediately shot by U.S. snipers. And when my friends went, they were still shot at by U.S. snipers, but they managed to get away, and they came back in one piece. And they actually did go back out the next day when there was more light and held up their passports and were able to collect some bodies and some wounded people, simply because they were Westerners. So they experienced it firsthand. And then what I saw when I was back at the clinic was one car after another of Iraqis bringing in women, children, one, even a grandmother still holding a white flag, people who were being shot anytime they left their homes for any reason. I mean, it was literally a massacre. They were literally shooting anything that moved and not making any differentiation between civilians and fighters. And there were then between 800 and 1,200 Iraqis killed during that failed siege. And, of course, the Iraqi Red Crescent estimates that at least 60% of them, very conservatively, were civilians. And then that was essentially a prelude to the current siege, where we had the same thing happening, mass civilian casualties precipitated by very, very heavy aerial bombardment, where we have entire families that still to this day, their bodies lay in the rubble of their homes. Military claims, they estimate 2,000 dead, and they also estimate that about 1,200 of those are fighters. Their appointed Prime Minister, Ayed Alawi, actually had the gall to say that all 2,000 of them were fighters, that not one civilian was killed. I have photo after photo of bodies in the streets that were left there, half eaten by dogs, of bodies that obviously have no entry or exit wounds from bullets or shrapnel, that their skin has very notable discolorations, and for example, why are their bodies not eaten by dogs where others are? So many people in the city did report the use of chemical weapons and phosphorus weapons, and of course, cluster bombs, which were used very heavily in both sieges. And so just to name a few instances, but it's basically war crime central. There's a reason why the military retains a very strict cordon around the city. No journalists are being allowed in. Anyone that goes up there and is found out to be a journalist is either turned away or detained. I've written a story about, for example, a French journalist who was detained, and it's essentially a concentration camp now. If anyone wants into the city, they have to get a retina scan and fingerprinted and get an ID to go inside to find out what's left of their home. Also, it's very interesting that the military itself handed out pamphlets to people going in that said, don't eat any food that was left in here during the siege, don't drink any water, or you'll get sick. They're handing out these pamphlets. They also went around and shot out all the water tanks on top of the houses, because if someone wanted to try to trace chemical weapons, that water would be the best way. So just to name a few examples, but it is war crime central, what's been done in Fallujah. It's a modern-day Dresden, and the truth will come out in the end.
What's your response to people when they talk about Fallujah saying, well, those people were told to leave. They were told the U.S. was going to be coming in. So if they, you know, hung around, then that's their fault.
Well, everyone who could leave did leave. Of course, there were, keep in mind, this is against the backdrop that it was just a few months before this, that in the same year where we had the other siege where people had to leave the city for at least a month. And they maybe didn't have the means to leave. While most did leave, there were at least 20,000 that did stay there. And they did because of financial reasons. They couldn't afford to go. They had nowhere to go. the refugee camps that did get set up, they were already overcrowded. There weren't enough tents. There weren't enough supplies like food and medicine. So many people didn't have the option to leave. And then some simply just didn't want to. They said, you know, I'm going to take the risk. I'm going to stay here and guard the house. Many family members chose to leave a boy or a son or sometimes the father to try to guard the house because they couldn't afford to have their things looted. They were still recovering from April. So again, when we look at it through that lens, I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to blame the victim when this is a city that has already been bombed, basically had the hell bombed out of it in April. It was so much fighting. And then this current siege where it was 60% of it was literally bombed to the ground. And then, you know, whoever is pointing the finger, whether it be the military or the corporate media, saying, well, these people just didn't leave. Well, I mean, think about this. This is their home. This is their city. They didn't have the option to leave, or they simply didn't want to because they didn't want to leave their things unguarded. I mean, there's a myriad of reasons, but that's, you know, when I hear that, I just shake my head because it's like, well, those people, why did they just stand there when we dropped the bombs on their head? They should have left. You know, I mean, that's basically what that's saying, and I think that's absolutely absurd.
Yeah, especially if you look at this country where, you know, we are conditioned for those lucky enough to find housing in houses themselves as opposed to, you know, apartment rentals or whatever. I mean, that's your lifetime investment is put into that house and to, like, walk away and leave it wide open for others. I just couldn't imagine people would do that here in this country. So how did you go about doing your interviews? How did you, like, arrange that, and did you use an interpreter?
I did. I have a very good interpreter. We've been working together now for over a year, and he speaks very good English. And he essentially also works as my fixer, which means he fixes the interviews and fixes any problem that comes up along the way. And he has his own car, so he's my interpreter, fixer, and driver all at once. And we're quite good friends at this point. And he would fix interviews, and we, because of the security situation now, we would leave the hotel at different times every day, take different routes when we left, and then drive around for a while to make sure we weren't being followed. And then typically would go directly to where we were going to interview these people, whether it was in their home or their office or a neutral place. And I would grow a beard to try to fit in and do my best and not speak English in public and minimize our time on the street. It's definitely a very dicey place to live. Aside from the kidnapping situation that has become so common and prevalent now, the other things are, of course, well, you know, car bombs, which you just have to accept that hopefully you're lucky enough that day that you're not going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it's difficult to work. It's hard to get it's almost impossible now to get accurate information from the military or from any of the Western companies working there. So that doesn't help either. And it's really a situation where it's become harder and harder on journalists. We've had, in a 14-month period alone, more journalists were killed in Iraq than were killed in the entire Vietnam War. This is augmented by the fact that we have Prime Minister Alawi making threats, literal threats, to journalists during, for example, the first week of the siege of Fallujah. He came out and literally said any journalist not reporting the government side of the story would be detained. So this is the atmosphere that you have to try to work in. I mean, if you think media repression is bad here, which it is, it's nothing compared to in Iraq, where we have, excuse me, literally a puppet regime that's created this Orwellian atmosphere for the media, where basically tell our side of the story or else.
And how much of that targeting of journalists did you feel came from the U.S. side?
Well, my experience with that is actually the only two times I've been shot at in Iraq have been by U.S. soldiers. I've had colleagues who've had their cameras smashed or stolen either by U.S. soldiers in Iraq or by the FBI back here at home. The media repression has been the greatest from either the U.S. installed Iraqi government and officials therein or by the military itself. Not all the military is that way. There are some people that would try to work with us, typically the newer soldiers on the ground there, who would say, sure, you know, you can take pictures of this, but please not of that. And they would try to be as accommodating as they could. But typically my experience was that the longer the soldier had been there, basically, they seemed to pass this point where they then had an attitude just like, screw it, you know, we're like, yeah, you can take the camera, but then we're going to take you can take the picture, but then we're going to take your camera. So definitely most of the challenges have come from the U.S. military side there. And we even saw a recent example highlighting that where we had an executive with CNN who said that very thing. He said that actually he believed the military actually had a policy of targeting journalists at times. And then, of course, promptly he was forced to step down.
You'd mentioned Western companies over there. What interactions and or observations did you make of what they were doing?
Well, to make a long story short, in sum, the big question is companies like Bechtel and Halliburton, Kellogg, Brown, and Root have been paid billions and billions and billions of dollars of U.S. tax dollars. And I can report that even looking very specifically at Bechtel's contract, particularly regarding the water infrastructure and the water treatment plants that they're supposed to be rebuilding, and next to nothing has been done whatsoever. 22 months into the occupation, we have the water situation and electricity and gasoline all far, far, far below pre-war levels across the board. There is essentially no infrastructure and essentially no rebuilding going on. Literally, there's some external paint jobs going on in some of the hospitals and some of the schools. Literally, that's it. There are a few exceptions, particularly down in Basra, where they have been able to get some work done. But throughout most of the rest of Iraq, it's literal corporate looting. The big question is, they've been paid all of these contracts. They've been found guilty of fraud, for example, KBR overcharging the Pentagon to ship in gasoline, which they got caught for in December 2003 and actually did make the mainstream media. And then, of course, they got a huge augmentation to their contract where they got even hundreds of millions of more U.S. taxpayer dollars. So the corporations are very effectively lining their pockets with U.S. taxpayer dollars in a situation where there's literally no oversight outside of people like myself and a few other independent reporters and some other foreign journalists who've gone and poked their noses around in some of these projects. There is literally no oversight there, so that's how they're getting away with it.
And again, jumping back to U.S. corporate coverage of the situation there, it's, as we mentioned earlier, a lot of it is played up on foreign fighters. Did you see any evidence or with any of your interactions with people there gleam any insight into mercenaries that are being brought in for, what we'll call security purposes here in the U.S. media?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. That's actually a very big way that the U.S. there is postponing the draft, because they really don't have enough soldiers there on the ground to try to accomplish what they want to accomplish. And so they're compensating for this by, there are between 30,000 and 70,000 mercenaries on the ground there, more coming in every day. These people are being paid between $500 and $1,500 a day to be there. They don't have to operate under the military rules of engagement, which means they can basically get away with whatever they want to do. I mean, they're literally hired guns. They are not quote-unquote security contractors. They are mercenaries. Let's call them what they are. They operate with free rein. They use munitions that are illegal if the military used them, certain bullets, that extra light bullets that will go through people's bodies and kill them in very interesting ways. And then also, when they are killed, their deaths aren't reported in the military casualty count. So we really don't have an accurate number of the deaths. Soldiers, actually, that's a bit of a different topic, but soldier deaths we don't have an accurate count of, and we have no public record whatsoever of how many mercenaries have been killed, and that's why I make such a gross estimate of between 30,000 and 70,000 be there, because are there, because no one really knows for sure. And of course, these companies really are not beholden to anyone to release that information to the media who wants to know, even though the fact is that it's you and I and other taxpayers that are paying for all of this. And yet, of course, they are accountable to no one.
And did you have the impression that the U.S. military is bringing these in, or is it companies like, let's say, Halliburton?
It's companies like Titan and Cassie, and, for example, one name of one of the companies of the mercenaries is Custer Battles. That's the name of a company. I'm not making this up. You can't make this up. So they are being brought in, paid by the government to come in. They do work with the military. They do work with CIA. They are responsible for doing some of the torturing that occurs in the detention facilities in Iraq. But they also have their own helicopters. They actually have their own vehicles on the ground where they'll go around and sometimes I see them operating on their own, and sometimes I see them literally mixed in with troops. And I wonder how that makes troops feel who are being paid, what is it, maybe between $24,000 or $36,000 a year on average, working side by side with someone making, well, you know, up 10 times that amount. It probably doesn't help the morale situation for the troops so much either.
All right. We only have a few minutes left, and I want to get back to the elections. What do you foresee with what has come of this supposed elections back on the 30th?
Well, I want to be real clear that these elections were 100% sham. They basically were held for the American public more than they were for the Iraqi people, because the books were cooked. That's why we had a delay in the counting of the votes. How is it possible that when the U.S. government has gone to great lengths to estimate the percentage of Shia in Iraq to be 60% of the population, and that, of course, the portrayed by all of them voting by the corporate media, and then when the results came out, they say there's 48, you know, the unified Shia list won 48% of the books, of the polls. So the question is, how are they going to react when they do not have the majority in the National Assembly, when they've been waiting for decades? They've been waiting for Saddam to be removed. They were happy about this. And then now, essentially, the election has been stolen from them. Abdul Hakim, the leader of that list, stepped down when the media announced this 48% figure because he knew it was not true. So there will be an intifada when the Shia don't get what they want from this National Assembly. And there will be the spark of civil war when the Kurds decide to go independent, which they will. It's not a matter of if, but when. So this election has essentially done nothing but created a very nice sell job for the American people to try to accept this failed occupation, while at the same time essentially further dividing the rifts that already existed in Iraq, and probably will create a civil war, one in which, of course, the U.S. military will be caught right in the middle of.
All right, and quickly, what do you see then as the solution to this?
I think the only solution at this point is to 100% withdraw as quickly as possible and to compensate every Iraqi who has suffered loss of a loved one or other damages from the occupation. Just massive across-the-board compensation for Iraqis, because they've suffered more under this occupation than they have even under the sanctions. And regarding the military, it's a 100% withdrawal. There is no way to save face. It was an illegal situation from the beginning, so at this point, the bottom line, the longer we stay there, the more U.S. soldiers and the more Iraqi civilians are being killed. And I think the only true solution at this point is a 100% immediate withdrawal.
All right. Well, you have a website that people can get your dispatches and photos from. What is that?
It's www.darjamailiraq.com. That's DARJAMAIL, Iraq.com.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks a lot for having me.
We've just been talking with Dar Jamail. He is an independent journalist who has just come back from 8 months in Iraq.